Rick, there's no phone number on here. I would call him.
What would you say?
Hey, Rick, what's up?
Why would you use a different voice?
I don't know.
It's David.
And he'd be like, is this a show about bikers?
Yeah.
Does that sound like him?
Yeah, it sounds just like him.
All right, well, do you want to start interviewing me as him? And we just see if...
Maybe he'll call me at some point.
Bling, 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 bling.
Oh, there he is. That's Rick.
Hey, whoa, ho! What's up?
What's going on, Rick?
Just, you know, living my best life.
How's Boston this time of year?
It's beautiful. Trees and everything else that's in Boston. Ships, tea. All looking good.
Excellent.
Anyway, I heard you guys have like some kind of nerdy audio program. So what's going on here?
Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David.
Check, check, check. Okay. So we have a special guest. I'm going to let David hear into this chat. Just want to make sure all our tech issues that we're known to have are sorted before we bring in a stranger that we don't know. So now I'm going to let David in. Here we go. Hello? Oh, he's eating cheese or bread. What you eating?
Freschetta, rising crust, pepperoni.
Okay. So how's pizza night? Let's open with that.
I walked in the door at 6:11, and then I looked at the frozen pizza, and it was like, preheat to 450, bake for 24 minutes. And I was like, we're going to be cutting it close on this recording time.
Yeah, but looks like you made it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can we get some good pizza foliage?
I like that you call my chewing foliage. Is that an industry term?
Yeah, so Foley sounds, anything you see in a movie, when anybody does any kind of motion, the rule is it needs to have a sound supporting it. So like if I do this where I rub my, you can see it, they can't, I'll describe what I'm doing. I'm wiping my brow with the back of my hand.
Yeah.
Because I've been sweating and I've been working and I've been working hard today, but I've mostly been sweating. So I'm wiping my sweat away. So I'll go, right, like you can't feel me wiping my brow.
Mm-hmm.
But if I use this sound effect,
I was supposed to do that.
I thought it was going to happen in post, but David jumped in. So we'll maybe just, let's do one more go, because now I'm curious what you'll come up
with. Am I making the sound effect, or are you doing it
this
in post?
This time you will.
Okay.
Let me set the scene. Oh, man. This corn just looks so ready to be shucked. I better get out there and start picking. Gonna start with this first one. Here comes another.
I thought you were wiping your brow. Oh, okay. All right.
I'm going to shuck this. Oh, wait, I'm going to pull this other corn. Better carry him back to the house in this sack that's resting against the ground. Oh, I got to open the door. Oh, hey, honey. Yeah, I got the corn. I'm just going to... God, you're always interrupting me. All right, I'm going to put the corn on the table. It's a little wetter than normal. All right, better start chucking it. There's one. All right, go start that oven with the water that gets hot and it makes the corn soft.
Beep, boop, beep, beep, boop, beep.
What year is this? Oh, sorry. Okay. It normally bings when it's ready for the corn.
Bing.
All right, gonna pick up this corn and carry it over. Putting it in the water. Oh, it's boiling real good. That's some good boiling corn where I come from. This is some weird corn.
Bing!
Oh, it's done. All right, taking it out. Hey, honey, come over here. I want you to try this fresh sweet. God, I hate it here. Go get those things that look like corn that you put in corn so you can eat it. Thank you. Now spread butter on this. On the corn. No, stop eating it. Stop. I haven't seasoned it.
I was expecting to just do you wiping your brow sweat.
All right, hold on. Let's finish with that. All right. I'm so ready to eat this perfect ear of corn. Better wipe my brow. That's the sound of me flicking the sweat against the wall as I do when I eat corn.
I think I did it perfectly. Yeah. If you know any openings for Foley artists, let me know.
Yeah, I'll just send them this file and be like, I mean, what can't he do? All right. So anything you want to say before we admit Rick Leskowitz?
Let's jump in.
Here we go.
Oh. There we go, Rick.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
How's your day going?
So far, so good.
Excellent. Excellent. We're both using laptops in various states of disrepair, so there will probably be more tech issues at some point. All right. So the intro I have for you, and please correct me if I get any of this wrong. You are a Harvard-affiliated psychiatrist specializing in pain management. And sort of through that, I learned that you've gotten into energy healing or just energy forces and how we interact with them. Is that all accurate to say?
Yes. Okay. So far, so good.
And I heard about you because I had some coworkers attend the energy healing conference in Reston, which happens to be about a quarter mile from where Evan is right now.
Yep.
Oh,
And I don't know if you remember the one coworker that was really interested in what you're doing. His name's Ian. He said he had a good conversation with you about the Red Sox. And they all got back from the conference and they said, David, you have got to get this guy on your podcast. He is perfect for it. And so I reached out to you and, you know, was lucky enough to have you agree to come on here. So thank you for coming on here. Thank you for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Thank you, for sure.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And I guess I just wanted to kind of start at the beginning of where you got here. What I heard is that you were doing some work on phantom limb pain, and that is sort of the jumping off point for you sort of moving into energy stuff. Is that accurate?
Not really. I was doing energy stuff and had an encounter with a phantom patient that
opened
up a different direction. I guess the fuller background would be that I got interested in energy-related stuff before I got into pain management. I took some time off between college and medical school and traveled around the world and saw that different cultures did things very differently. Spent some time in India and Nepal, and you know they have a very different view of healing and health than we do. Mm-hmm. So I came back to medical school and was kind of disappointed because there really weren't explanations for a lot of illnesses. They use the word idiopathic. It sounds like an impressive word, but it basically means we don't know what's going on. And it was only when a friend invited me to a lecture on healing that I got open to all this stuff, because it was presented by a woman who worked with the doctors in Los Angeles, but she could perceive and feel and work with energies. So I began to study with her. Her name was Rosalind Briere. And that was like, she had explanations for things that the doctors couldn't. And she could work with the energy and shift what was happening. Her model was, if the energy changes, then the physical body changes, which is what traditional Chinese medicine says, and Ayurveda and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that was an eye-opener. And we learned how to do some different kinds of energy-based techniques. I wasn't particularly good at it. It was actually important for my development to have the experience of being the dumbest kid in the class. Because other people were really gifted.
Did you get support when you wanted to kind of go down that avenue, or was that seen as a little strange to want to pursue that?
Well, I wasn't like telling everybody about it, but you know, my closest confidants.
Yeah, okay.
This was back in the mid 80s, so it wasn't as mainstream as it is now.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always a few people who you can share some of your forbidden interests with. And so I had a support group around that.
Right.
But even if I hadn't, this lady was so illuminating for what I was really hoping to learn about. Mm-hmm. She ended up giving workshops. She's based in LA, but she came out to Western Massachusetts twice a year for these intensives. And so I started going to those. And there's a group of about 30 or 40 of us. And some people could just see, you know, it was like they had x-ray vision and could see into you. And at first I thought it was nuts, but you know, you can validate it in what they said to me and what they did to me. So I was, you know, I was on board. And the challenge was how to integrate this into the clinical work that I was doing. And that was a bit of a stretch. I was working in a pain management program where with chronic pain, nothing works. Patients are willing to try anything, and doctors are willing to try anything because they go do whatever you want. You know, what do we got to lose? So we were already doing some, things like meditation and biofeedback. But it turns out a couple of the other therapists and myself had side trainings in some of these hands-on energy techniques. So we began to introduce it, and the patients really loved it. They responded very well. So it became more and more a part of what I was doing. The phantom limb thing that you mentioned was really important in terms of my understanding of energy. Just quick background. It's very common when people have a amputation for whatever reason. It could be an accident or a military or a surgical or whatever. After it's over, they feel as though the limb is still there. And often it's very painful. Actually, I had one guy who lost part of his leg and he needed to walk with a prosthesis, but he slept without it. And it took him a while to get used to it, because when he would wake up in the morning and get out of bed, he would fall over because, as he said, I didn't have a leg to stand on. Because it felt like his leg was still there.
Yeah, it took that to
realize it. So the usual medical model is that your brain is just trying to compensate for the missing input that it used to get. And it creates this illusion that the limb is still there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the medical model is that the brain is primary and the brain creates your experience of reality. You know, I sort of believed it, sort of didn't believe it, because there wasn't much room for energy. But what happened was I had learned a technique called therapeutic touch, in which, well, you can do it now if you want, just putting your hands far apart and closer together without touching. You can close your eyes to actually tune in better, but somewhere around a foot apart, you'll start to feel something different. It's not the temperature sensation.
Yeah.
So this whole therapy is based on, what is that?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. As tingling or pressure or something like that. So the idea is that that your body has its own sort of magnetic field around it. And in this therapy, you feel it and you smooth it out and people feel better afterwards. So I had one leg amputee patient who wasn't doing well with the usual exercises and stress management stuff. So I said, do you want to try something different? And of course, you know, he's got nothing to lose. So he lay down on the examining table. I told him, just close your eyes and relax and just see what happens. And I started doing this. It's an assessment, because you feel to see if there's any places where it really tingles or goes cold or something like that. And kept smoothing out. And out of force of habit, I went all the way down his leg, his missing leg, only to realize that I could feel that same pressure sensation even where his leg was missing.
So you're saying you're doing like therapy to a missing body part?
Yes. Yes. It was empty space to my eyes.
Yeah.
My hands could feel something that...
You could feel the energy of the missing leg.
Whatever it was, yes. So that was half of it. The other half of it was he opened his eyes and said, what are you doing, doc? Because he could feel me touching his phantom limb. So neither of those things can happen by the traditional medical model. So something else is going on.
Yeah.
I'm curious, when you did that therapy, did it alleviate some of the phantom limb pain?
Well, it actually took us a couple of minutes to realize whoa, what the heck is going on here? Because it was so out of the ordinary from either of our experiences.
Yeah.
Then what he described was he could feel the pain as though it was a substance draining out the bottom of his phantom foot.
Huh.
Like a faucet, and it was draining out there. He didn't know it, and I didn't know it at the time, but it's a very important acupuncture point for the start of the kidney meridian. So he was feeling the pain draining out and was telling me that. And I was getting really psyched about, ooh, miracle cure.
Yeah.
And then he said, actually, doc, could you stop? And I said, but why? It's getting better. Your pain is going away. And he said, it's too weird a feeling to not have any sensation in his leg. That for him, the pain, in a way, it was uncomfortable and unpleasant and all that. But it also made him feel as though at some level his leg was still there. And he was a young, athletic guy. And the idea of missing a leg, he couldn't quite fully accept psychologically. So his pain actually served a positive function for him. And he wasn't willing or able to let it go at that point.
If I have the timeline right, you're doing this work while you're in med school.
Oh, sorry, I left out a few years in between that.
Okay.
In med school, I was more into the mind-body stuff of meditation.
Okay.
And then I went to a residency in psychiatry where the stress factor was acknowledged and what they were calling psychoneuroimmunology. But now that I think of it, I didn't really get my first energy exposure until I worked in the VA system and one of my colleagues at the VA introduced
me. Okay.
I assume with your medical training, they don't go into that?
At that stage, people weren't even buying acupuncture. New and weird. And I still remember an anatomy professor who asked him about it. And he said, acupuncture only works in China because the Chinese citizens are obeying Chairman Mao, behavioral conditioning or something like that.
Like brainwashing is making it work.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So they totally blew off the rest of it. So I got some good advice from one of my instructors who was sympathetic to it. He said, don't talk about energy fields and auras. Talk about electromagnetic fields.
Okay. Because then they're like, oh, okay.
So that made a big difference. People could relate to that. But that still didn't explain the phantom limb, because the electromagnetics, you think all the stuff happening in the body just sort of generates magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
But this experience, it was primary. It was there even though there was no body to emit it. So that flipped things inside out. And that's really where I got into the full esoteric model of energy.
Yeah. I mean, I can see you.
So you really found yourself sort of straddling both worlds and trying to make sense of all of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I feel like every time we have a guest on here, there's a point where I ask the Mulder and Scully question. Are you familiar with the X-Files?
My favorite TV show for 10 years, but yeah.
So the two main characters on there are Mulder, who believes in any and everything under the sun, like, you know, aliens, cryptids, all the stuff, believes in everything. There's nothing off the table. And then the other character is Scully, and she is a medical doctor who is grounded in science and doesn't believe any of it. And so I'm curious, where would you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I think that what was so skillful about that show was that we each have a Scully and a Mulder side to us.
It's true.
And, you know, I grew up with the skeptical side, but my you know, Mulder part started to open up with these experiences and began to realize that the truth is out there and the truth is in here, and you gotta pay attention to both.
When you first came in, were you full like it needs to be explained by science, or does what you saw as you got into the field kind of expand thinking more, maybe it can't be explained by math, science, whatever?
Well, I came in believing that science had the answers to everything. Mm-hmm. And really, that word idiopathic, the more I think about it, had a big impact on me, because I was so disappointed to realize
it. It was just
a bullshit term to cover their ignorance. So I had to, you know, I was curious. I really want to know, why did this person get that disease at this time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That doesn't really answer any of the questions. So the energy realm really opened up a lot. And it turns out all the other healing traditions in the world, except for Western medicine, have this idea of invisible healing energy. And so that helped to validate it for me, plus the personal experiences.
And so I know that your research into energies eventually expanded into doing some research with the Boston Red Sox and crowd energy and everything. And I wanted to touch on that because I'm a big football fan, American football. And like when I've been to games, I can feel the energy. And I've watched enough now that I'm a middle-aged man that even if I'm watching a game on TV, I find myself, I don't have any investment on who wins or not. I'm just watching for fun, but I can like feel through the TV, like the flow of the game is what I call it. And like halfway through a game, more often than not, I can tell you who's going to win just based on how the energy of the game feels. And so I'm curious to just talk about that topic with you, because it's something that really interests me, is sort of crowd energies and how they influence what's going on around them.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And it is a fascinating topic. I got into it from the energy point of view, because people interact through their energy fields, like a doctor and a patient. They have an energy interaction. It's not always therapeutic touch. It's just like, you know, having a heart-to-heart conversation or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Work teams and things like that, they build a certain kind of cohesion. But one of the most vivid or dramatic examples is team sports, as you're saying. And, you know, I grew up in the Boston area, and our Red Sox were terrible for many, many years. Close calls, but it never really clicked until 2004 when we won the World Series. And that was such a dramatic kind of thing, but it really felt like all of New England was caught up in it. And you had that sort of positive vibe, whether you're at the game or just watching it or just in the streets afterwards. So I got very interested in that. My cousin is a filmmaker, helped to pull together a project with the Red Sox that they actually cooperated and let us go to Fenway Park and interview the players and interview the fans. And we did some recordings with it. There are some ways of measuring group attention. And we put it together in a documentary film that I think came out great, but it didn't become a box office smash like I thought it was going to. But
you want to drop it? We'll give it a boost from our friends and family.
The joy of socks, right?
Right. Yeah, we'll notice an uptick in sales. It was called The Joy of Socks. And I don't know if you guys are of the age to get the joke there, but there was a best-selling book back in the 70s called The Joy of Sex.
Okay.
The first mainstream book to talk about sexuality, you know, in a matter-of-fact way, that this is part of humanism.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It became a big thing. So Joy of Socks is a great... But the joy of it was a really important thing, that emotion was what really carried the team. And so we had players like David Ortiz talking about how much it meant to him to have a positive energy, the fans rooting for him. So people can access it. I have a website. It's called themysteryoflifeenergy.com, because that's the name of my newest book. But under the resources section, the first click down is the movie. It ended up showing on PBS about 10 or 12 years ago, and it's about an hour long, and it's pretty fun. I think it holds up pretty well, but it illustrates the points that you're making, David, about the power of the fans.
Yeah.
One kind of unusual computer program that can measure it, and it correlated exactly the moments where the fans were most into it, whether they're cheering or whether they're just, you know,
yeah.
The computer spiked at those moments. So there's definitely something there.
Because you mentioned in that documentary, I forget exactly what you said, but something to the effect of the positive crowd energy is the best depression cure that you've ever witnessed. And I can tell you, similarly, the Sox won it in what, 04?
Yeah.
Was it?
In February of 18, the Philadelphia Eagles, which is my football team, beat the New England Patriots and won the Super Bowl.
And
I can remember that vividly. And I think just on pure joy, I was awake for like 36 hours straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just running on this joy of the sports team winning.
Yeah.
And so what you were saying in that documentary really hit with me, because I've experienced it.
Yeah.
And you did something in there where you put on headphones and an eye mask, and you had the fans around you sort of reacting to see if you could pick up on the energies. And you did.
Yeah, that was actually, looking back on it, was a very cool experiment that we did, where, as you say, I was blindfolded and I couldn't hear anything. And I was sitting in a lab of a place called the HeartMath Institute, because they study the rhythm of the heartbeat and see how emotions affect it. And different kinds of meditations have different effects on your heart rhythm, and your heart rhythm affects your brain rhythm. It's sort of the opposite of what you might expect. So they have this device where you just measure your pulse. It could be on your finger, or I think in this one, they had a clip on my earlobe in the lab. And I was just sitting at my relaxed baseline, which was, you know, pretty relaxed. but I didn't have this, what they call heart coherence rhythm of deep relaxation until I think it was four meditators came in. They sat behind me. I couldn't see them or hear them. And a signal from the clairvoyant, they began to do their heart math meditation. And within like 10 seconds, my heart coherence started going up and up and up and up and up, even though I didn't do or know anything consciously. The best analogy is tuning forks.
Okay.
They were vibrating at this frequency, and I began to resonate in harmony with them. And I could feel it too. You know, there was something kind of positive and uplifting about it. Even though they weren't saying anything, there wasn't any content. It wasn't a game where you could react to the events of the game. It was something invisible in the air. And that the fact that that demonstration actually worked. we didn't know whether it was going to work or not, but it did. And that was a very powerful example for me. So I think the same thing happens in a stadium or a crowd or at home watching. That you hear the expression that the emotions are contagious. Well, mm-hmm. That's how it happens. It is like tuning forks. I think that's a really good comparison to use. So, yeah, I mean, you know, in Philadelphia that day, there was very positive emotions. In Boston, there were very negative emotions. I don't know if you know the ongoing question about we didn't play one of our best cornerbacks.
Oh, yeah. And I'm happy you didn't.
Yeah, no. Foles we couldn't stop him because we didn't put in. This is a little bit off the track.
No, go for it. Go for it.
But that's a whole other thing about what was going on behind the scenes, why Belichick didn't play.
Why?
Who could have stopped them? And nobody has ever answered that question.
No, they haven't. I'm wondering, you know, having this conversation with you, if making that drastic of a decision at game time maybe threw off the energy in the Patriots locker room.
Now that's a really great point, because obviously the other teammates knew, why don't you put in Butler and, you know, let him do his thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good point. Actually, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but that must've thrown off their chemistry right at the start when they realized one of the pieces was missing for whatever mysterious reason. And they might've known, you know, it could have been some behind the scenes argument or scuffle or something. There's all sorts of rumors, but you know, everybody's waiting for Belichick to write his memoirs and maybe tell the story then, but no, so far, no deal.
Now, keeping with the sports theme, how are you feeling about the Sox winning streak?
Well, this is interesting because I don't follow the Sox anymore, hardly at all.
Oh, really?
Partly because I don't get cable, you know, and I don't recognize the names of the players. That once they started unloading all their stars like Mookie Betts, I began to think that, you know, it's just a money-making venture for the owner. And
sadly.
So then all of a sudden, something clicked. And that's a question, too, of what happened. And I think this really does tie into the overall theme, because the Sox and many sports teams have gotten very heavily into what they call analytics, mm-hmm. to figure out what to do in any given situation or with any given player. You know, growing up, the statistics were batting average and how many home runs, and that was about it. And now they have all these things like launch angles and spin rate. And you know, it's like computer analysis of everything. And the players have to learn that and adjust their style to fit the statistics rather than to fit what they feel most natural in their natural flow state with. And I think that was why this Red Sox were doing so poorly. A bunch of things happened all at once where they fired the manager and the coaches. And one of the players, apparently, he got so fed up that he said, screw this. I'm just going to go with the flow and do it my way. And he broke out of his slump. A couple of others did it too. They fired the coordinator of the statistics program called Driveline. And the team clicked. The new manager was excellent at building the team chemistry. And their positive expectations, you know, their belief system.
Yeah.
They said, we can do this. You know, now that we can throw out that statistics crap, we can do it the way we've all been doing it since Little League, where you feel it. And I think that really had a huge part to play in their turnaround. Whether they can keep it up the rest of the year, I don't know. But it's been a very interesting process to watch.
I did not know that about them firing the analytics guy. And you're right. I think baseball is sort of the pinnacle of it. But a lot of sports have really just become sort of a math game that people play and just throw everything into a machine and it tells you what decision to make. And yeah. A lot of the feeling has been lost in sports lately.
And, you know, not to get too grandiose about it, but I think that's the direction society is going. It's just everything is digital, as though the answers to everything are digital or computers or artificial intelligence or analysis. And it leaves out the flow and the energy and the really the heart of the matter. People go into sports because they love the feelings, and you can't analyze every feeling. So this is another kind of fork in the road that we have to decide where we're headed.
Yeah, I'm sure Evan has some strong feelings on AI going into audio and video work.
We're all doomed, but you know, some of us will make it out. No, I mean, I get why. It's like you can analyze stuff down to like the smallest detail,
yeah,
but sometimes math can't explain away just creative input. Right. Like sometimes it's the outlying thing that kind of makes it work versus the mathematical approach.
Yeah. Yeah. This is sort of what medicine is like too. It's breaking everything down into smaller and smaller parts, figuring, somehow we'll be able to put all the parts together again, but medicine hasn't really paid attention to what holds it together.
Mm-hmm.
Is it this balance and homeostasis? And that's where the energy comes in.
Well, and sometimes it's a thing from like way out here that somebody happened to bring in with no knowledge that, you know, starts off the new thing.
Right. It's the paradigm shift, as they call it.
Yeah.
You've done energy research for 40 years now. Where you're at now, what do you think the limits of it are?
I actually don't think there are limits.
Okay.
I think a lot of it depends on really, there are, like with my phantom limb person, the pain, which the outsiders thought was bad and we got to get rid of it, served a positive function for him. And I think that happens in many illnesses, not as the main cause of it, but it's an obstacle to full healing. But there are ways to get energetics lined up so that the physical body can cure, but there are so many factors working against it, like just environmentally, the pesticides in our food and the pollution in the air and the electromagnetic radiation. Those are all unnatural things that are continuously knocking us off balance. And it takes a lot of internal work to keep aligned despite all that stuff going on. And when you have an illness or a symptom, it forces you to reflect back in and saying, what's out of balance here?
Mm-hmm.
Pain management, the temptation is to make the pain go away and give them some injection or medication and you block the signal, but it's really an alarm signal that's telling you something's out of whack, and you can quiet the signal to make life livable, but then you got to go back and say, what am I doing that's throwing my system out of whack? And it could be just a postural thing or, you know, musculoskeletal thing, but oftentimes it's emotions that we don't know how to deal with can get stored in the body, because we all know emotions have a lot of energy and you can feel it in your system. If you've been told that big boys don't cry, for example, all three of us grew up hearing,
mm-hmm,
that makes it very challenging when you're really sad. What do you do then? And, you know, some people just clamp it down and they get a sore throat or, you know, pneumonia or whatever. I mean,
I thought you just took it out on others. I thought that was what I was.
Yeah, that's a good one too. There are a lot of these psychological, physical linkages through the emotions and the energies that we're really starting to piece together. The therapy technique that I've come to appreciate the most, it's sort of a spin-off of acupuncture. It's where you teach a patient how to tap on their own acupuncture points, kind of like this,
mm-hmm,
while they're calling to mind something that's upsetting to them. I'll say something like, think about something that really stresses you out. Where do you feel it in your body and how strong is it? And then say some kind of statement of acceptance, like, even though I'm still having these emotions after 20 years, I accept myself fully and I choose peace of mind. And you say that and you go through these tapping points and people have the reaction of, which, you know, it's a very common release of tension, but it's also getting your energies back into alignment. So this approach, it's best known as EFT, emotional freedom technique. There's a lot of clinical studies now showing how helpful it is. So that's my preferred direction to aim people. And there are studies now with many different physical illnesses responding to this energy-based therapy. So our whole model, our whole paradigm is in the process of shifting now.
And EFT dropped out for me. Can you say that again? What did that stand for?
emotional freedom technique.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with Ulf Sandstrom. I've met him a couple times and done some trainings with him on EFT.
Oh, great. And from Vanilla. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They came over to where I work a couple summers ago and they spent a week with our team and we did some trainings and stuff with them. And it was really interesting, some of the stuff that we learned from them.
Wait, do you work at the county jail system?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. That I forgotten the woman's name who did this.
Carrie.
Yeah, that was incredible. Yeah. So, okay. So yeah, we had some nice conversation. Yeah. So that's an example where it's a totally different world. He's talking about addictions and imprisonment and what's the emotional charge underneath it that the prisoners have just learned to use drugs to suppress.
Right.
But you can use some of these techniques to get at it so that you don't need the drugs to do what they've been doing. Oh, that was.
So the program that we do is working on substance abuse problems. And really a lot of the treatments that we do have nothing to do with substance abuse. It's more, you know, EFT, meditation, havening, different techniques, acupuncture, yoga, those things to get at, like you said, the underlying issues that are causing the substance use.
Yeah, that would be great as that spreads, that model, because it's so inspiring to say hello to them for me.
Yeah, that's the whole team that came back and they were like, Rick is fantastic and you got to talk to him.
Yeah, he took my breakout lecture. Yeah.
And so I'm curious, you know, you mentioned there's all sorts of stuff in the food we eat, the air we breathe, radio waves and stuff going through the air. And so, you know, we can't avoid most of that stuff. So I'm curious, do you have any routine or practices that you just sort of do daily to sort of check your energy, write things? Do you do anything in particular, like on a normal basis that like anybody could do?
I have to admit, I'm not very conscientious about having like a regular practice that every day I meditate for 20 minutes.
Okay.
I've done different things in different phases at different times. But now at this stage of my life, what I find the most healing is to just step outside and look around. Because we lived in a suburb of Boston for many years when I worked at Spalding and raised our kids and all. But now that I'm retired, we moved out to the western part of Massachusetts, where it's just beautiful rural hills and fields and birds and crickets. And nature is very, very healing. And so just sitting out there in the evening and listening is like my meditation practice. I do make an effort to walk barefoot as much as I can. And that's an energy-based practice that's called earthing.
Okay.
Actually has a lot of science behind it, that our bodies need to be connected electrically to the earth. And wearing shoes, you know, rubber-soled shoes, it's an insulator and it disconnects us from it. So the static sort of builds up. And there are studies showing that inflammation and immunity and things like that are all affected when you either walk barefoot or they have these devices that sort of make the connection for you. And that's one particular thing.
So can I ask, my sister also is like big on Sedona and there being like this vortex. I haven't been there personally, so I can't speak to it, but seem to feel a lot of energy and vibe there. Why don't you guys want to like live there and experience it constantly?
Yeah.
Because Massachusetts seems far away from that, to go in that area and have an experience with the energy there. Why don't you want to just live there, be there all the time?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a fair question. And just to put it in the context, what David, his colleagues were talking about, they went to the conference for the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, ASEP. And one year we held it in Phoenix and organized a side trip to Sedona. Was it Phoenix or Albuquerque? I can't even remember now. I think Phoenix. But we did a side trip to Sedona and Yeah, a busload of people who came with a colleague and I were the head of it. But a local healer who was attuned to those energies led us through a bunch of exercises so that you could really feel that there was something different there. And, you know, part of my this would be my skeptical, my Scully part of my mind, or something. Well, it's suggestion, and everybody, you know, there's peer pressure to feel it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can concoct reasons like that, but when you close your eyes and quiet your mind, what is that tingling feeling? You know, And it was more noticeable there. Sedona's not the only place in the world like that. And there have been, well, in China, they have this tradition of studying earth energy. It's called feng shui. We mostly know about it in terms of interior decorating. You know, you put the door here.
Yeah, yeah. But
But they also did it for outside to be in alignment with nature. Mm-hmm. And in the West, we have a similar practice called geomancy. And especially in England, they mapped out these lines of force across England. Mm-hmm. There are, along the way, there are all these sacred sites and churches and chapels and Neolithic stone circles.
So you're saying you don't need to be at the epicenter to like pick up on the vibe. You can still...
Well, one of the maps a fellow made, his book is called Gaia Matrix. And it has a diagram of North America with the same kind of what they call ley lines and power points. And it turns out one of the biggest ones in North America is right where I live now.
Oh, there you go.
It's in Shelburne Falls. I didn't know that when we moved here, but it's not even that you feel it. It's just that a lot of interesting things happen here.
Yeah.
A lot of very creative people who happen to live here. There's meditation centers and retreat centers all over the place. So I think people are attracted somehow.
Yeah.
At an unconscious level to places like here or Sedona or Stonehenge or what have you.
And so that kind of segues perfectly into the next sort of series of things I wanted to chat with you about. And you're researching energies with like individuals. How did you make the transition, or what was that like to then sort of move into energies of places with like ley lines, stone structures, those things, going from people to places? What was that like?
Well, all right, I can't resist this one. I have been interested in aliens for a long time.
There we go.
And I actually married one about 50 years ago.
Is she green, or what's the criteria?
She's British.
Oh, well, say no more. Yeah.
When we were working on, you know, she was a resident alien before she became naturalized. We went to the consulate to get her visa or something like that. And he was asking us questions. And I was answering the questions. And this consulate guy said, "Let the alien speak." We were too, you know, anxious and young to take advantage of the situation. But, you know, she could have said, "Affirmative, I will obey," because that's what it sounds like.
Uh-huh. Anyway, right.
Long story short, she's from England. So we visited England a lot. So over the years, I got to go to places like Stonehenge and Avebury and really see these incredibly so different than anything I've ever experienced before. So that's where I got into it. I had been doing the energy stuff already, and then going here and mm-hmm. as something separate until gradually realizing that there's...
So made you believe in it more seeing it on the English side?
Yes. Although, yeah. You know, at first it was just fascinating archaeology type of things. And you know, why would they do this? And how come they put the stones here and things like that?
Yeah.
But what really tilted the balance for me was, I think the first one we saw was maybe 30 years ago, 25 years ago, a crop circle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Same part of Southern England where Stonehenge and Avebury and other stone circles are. And that was just so different and so incredible, really, that that's what opened my eyes to, you know, I kind of at some level thought I'd never seen a UFO. I thought, well, maybe there's something to it, but these are so different and so impossible for humans to make anything like it that mm-hmm. that's really opened my eyes to the whole.
So you came into it pretty open-minded, it sounds like, the how we're here, what's here.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a skeptical side to it, and the way the media has treated it, the main story was there were a couple of retired farmers in England who claimed that they were making all these crop circles by taking a plank of wood and dragging it.
Yeah, that was going to be my question.
I've heard that theory.
Using it to stomp down the wheat stalks. And, you know, they even did a demonstration, which from high above, It's a circle with a couple of straight lines and a little bit raggedy. But when you look up close, you can see it's just a mesh, and all the wheat is crushed and broken. And when you see genuine crop circles, they are 100 times larger than anything these guys could make.
So it seems like you're good on picking up on like energy stuff. Was that your draw to crop circles? Is when you saw that one, you could feel something from it? Or what was the draw?
No, I think the draw was actually, at first, it was more mathematical. Because some of the well-known ones, there's one that's it's literally across the street from Stonehenge. There's a fairly large road that goes, you know, maybe 50 yards from the border of Stonehenge. And on the other side is a big wheat field. And the story is that a lot of ultralight vehicles fly over that whole region so that tourists can take aerial pictures of Stonehenge. And there was one, you know, it was like an August afternoon in 1996, I think it was, flying this way. It was just a wheat field. And then when they had to turn around and come back an hour later, in the field across from Stonehenge was this spiral formation that was, it's actually 900 feet from one end to the other, made up of a series of circles with smaller circles spinning off of in the pattern that's mathematically called a logarithmic spiral. Mm-hmm. So it's mathematically precise, incredibly intricate, and it just appeared out of nowhere during the day with nobody saw anything because there's traffic going by. There's the tourists at Stonehenge. It's a little bit higher up. You can look down into it. So something incredibly different was happening. And so I think it was the mathematical beauty of it.
The precision of the spirals and how it worked in the whole of a bigger piece was what
yes.
made you, yeah, interesting. Yes. Okay, cool.
So there are, I have had some energy experiences in a crop circle. One of them was I sat inside one and meditated and felt the sort of, what would you say, acceleration. You know, usually it takes like an hour to get to this level of time and focus, and it was like within 3 minutes it happened. So you can't really, it's not quantifiable, but I know something happened. So that's the kind of experience I've had.
Yeah, I had always thought, like you said at the top, you know, I was just under the impression that crop circles had been proven to be a hoax. But what you're saying is that they are far beyond what a human would be capable of doing.
Yeah. I mean, there are some that are definitely hoaxed, and you'll see some that are like made to be like advertising logos for corporations. Like that.
It says Coors Light, so I'm not sure
really,
if that's a real
one. on that level. And from above, it looks, you know, it's kind of impressive, but if you look at it closely, it doesn't.
So when you get down like in a legitimate crop circle, do the plants just look pushed over? Are they burned in any way? Like structurally, how is it done?
Well, it's not always the case, but there, wheat, for example, grows in segments and there's a node at each segment.
Okay.
I have a sample that I'm pretty sure there's a picture of it on my website. I can't remember what's where. If people really want to see the pictures in my book, there's a chapter on earth energies. But the wheat grows this way, and then at the first node, it bends like this, and then at the second node, it bends like that. So the rest of the stalk is horizontal, and there were hundreds of them all like that. But it's rigid. It's not like it's snapped and it happens to be there. It's fused into this new angled position, and there's just no way that we don't know how to do that. It's like glass. It's like glass blowing where you heat it up, it gets soft, you move it to a new position and let it cool off, and it's stuck in that new position. Somehow or other, some sort of energy input, people have speculated about microwave radiation or something, but to be able to control it that precisely for each individual stalk, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them into a pattern, it's just, you know, mind-boggling.
Do you feel like you can show up to a site and immediately be like, this has potential, or does it take some time to kind of figure out?
It's a fair question. Like we were just there this summer and I had a harder time clicking to it, partly because of the weather, actually. It was just really, really hot. I don't know if you know, they're having a heat wave there. And it was just sort of physically uncomfortable to be there. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have that sort of openness to grok it, if you will.
So your personal vibe can affect your ability to read when you show up to the site, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, it's like you're in a different mood or something like that. And sometimes you're more receptive and other times you're not.
Yep.
And also from ground level, you can't tell what the big pattern is. So I think for me, part of it is just the amazement at the big pattern. but they're just so precise. And I do have a blog that people could go to the website and sign up on the blog. I'm just finishing part two of our trip to England, which has a couple of pictures where you can see the path where the crops are laid down compared to the upright stalks. And it's like each individual one, there's no, it's just very hard to talk about with words because it's so different than what you would expect.
It sounds like a human wouldn't even be able to do one stalk like that. And this is thousands of stalks.
That's correct. And they're all laid down in a flowing pattern. It's not like they're crunched and broken and squished and stomped. So, you know, the fact that so many people still think it's those two farmers, that says a lot about the power of the media. And it really makes me feel that there is some sort of intention to keep it suppressed.
Well, so that's where you're kind of leading me is, okay, so not human made or whatever. Like, do you feel like you have a good idea where they come from or too cosmic or whatever to possibly identify?
Not specifically, but sort of a side path that has helped me understand it more is over the years, I've been interested in information that is channeled. That for, I guess you guys and your listeners probably know what channeling is, but somebody will get information from an awareness, a consciousness that's not their own. And there's a couple of sources over the years that I had come to rely on. And a couple of them were saying about crop circles, because you can ask them questions. And they were saying that crop circles they're not designs that are coded messages, because a lot of people are trying to analyze what the symbolism of this particular design is. And it's like an electrical diagram or, you know, like a wiring diagram or a map of a solar system or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the message was, it's not something to be analyzed. It's something to be amazed at.
Like alien art. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. That's actually the analogy that they use.
That's a great idea. I love that.
Yeah. That they're painting on a canvas. The reason that Southern England and around Stonehenge is where so many, the crop circles happen all around the world. There's over 50 countries that it happened, but like 3/4 of them are within these few miles of Southern England. So the question is why there? And they said that it's because the energetics of the earth, the ley lines, PowerPoints are so clear and so aligned that it makes for a good canvas, quote unquote, for the, you know, the higher dimensional beings to connect with the physicality of the earth.
Yeah.
And that's why it happens there as opposed to some of these other places around the world.
I would still say I feel like art is meant to like convey a message though of some sort, or do you feel like it's purely abstract? Like this is a way for us to communicate. Here's something that looks cool, or are they trying to say anything?
Right. I think the message is that there's more to the world than just analyzing and, you know, breaking things down. And that the sense of amazement is a way to break away from our old worldview.
Yeah.
And to just have that sense of wonder that there's way more going on than we have opened up to. And, you know, one of the channeling said something about that they're putting in new frequencies for the earth to help bring about this transformation. You know, obviously if the aliens were as evil they could have destroyed us a long time ago. So
yeah, they're very patient from what I can tell.
Yeah.
One of our season one episodes, I feel like sort of channeling adjacent. We tried remote viewing with zero experience, zero training. And we actually got some pretty interesting results just from jumping right into the deep end with it. Now I'm picking up on that crop circles are something that's been happening for a long time, because I thought erroneously that this was like a phenomenon that happened in the 90s and then sort of died out and doesn't happen anymore. But you're saying like you saw some crop circles last month.
Yeah, no, that's, I think your impression is sort of the common one that's been, you know, it made a big splash, but then the media, for whatever reason, you know, CIA influenced or whatever, has minimized it. And America knows almost nothing about it. In England, obviously, they hear more about it. But it's continued so that every year there are still a fair number of clearly genuine circles. But it varies. Like, I think it was 2 years ago, there were maybe 6 or 8 obviously legitimate ones throughout the season. This past year, there were 15 or 20 that were good enough, and we happened to time it right so that we got to see three of them up close when we were in England. That was in July. In some of the circles, after the field is cleared, after it's harvested, a few weeks to a month later, the grass starts to grow up again in the same pattern as the crop circle that had been cut.
Oh, so it affected the energy in the ground even.
Yes. And so sometimes it just pops up quicker there. There's two really good images. Again, I can't remember where I posted them, but the following spring, the seeds that sprout out the first mirror the same pattern as the crop circle.
Okay. Can I ask, when you meditate away from a crop circle versus in a crop circle, what is the difference in the vibe or what you see in your mind's eye, or is that how it even works?
Well, the one time that I did intentionally meditate inside a crop circle, part of it was just a sense of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was cognitive too. Oh my God, I'm inside a crop circle. This is so cool. You know,
it seems like a good energy place to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I think it is similar to Sedona and places like that in that regard. I didn't have a particular, you know, image of a extraterrestrial from the Pleiades or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I haven't had that many opportunities to meditate inside a crop circle to sort of get the hang of it.
But right.
I'm sure that's there. So one way of thinking about it is that they're like portals to a, you know, easier access to different dimensions than just the physical one that we're used to.
Mm. Why are they made? Is it to go there and to meditate and see through these portals, or are we still trying to figure out why they're even making them? I know you said like to just appreciate their artistic, it's like something could just be made to be beautiful, or do you feel like there's a higher level intent for why these are being made for us, or is it even for us?
Yeah, I think there is a higher level intent that I think humanity has given out a lot of signals that we're kind of veering off in a dangerous direction.
Yep.
And there is some sort of prime directive that other civilizations are not allowed to interfere directly. And so this is like an indirect way of
trying to get us back on track.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who are waking up and saying the way things are going now is not right. Well, just the fact that this podcast like you guys are doing is part of this whole process of, I really think there is a kind of global awakening. So you're a part of it. Crop circles are a part of it. People don't have to actually go into a circle. You just see a couple of pictures and realize, wow, what is going on?
Yeah.
So I do think there is some sort of, I'll just say, non-human intelligence that's behind the circles. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe when we have Disclosure Day, we'll learn more about it. Which, actually, do you know that new Steven Spielberg movie?
I haven't seen it, yeah, but I've heard of it. What you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You guys definitely should see it then, given your interest. Because, you know, most of it is about evidence for UFOs, and they have manufactured some footage of the Roswell alien. Most of it is like Indiana Jones sort of prolonged chase scene.
Okay.
But there is one scene that lasts for maybe 5 seconds in which one of the main characters is standing in a wheat field, and all of a sudden a crop circle forms around him.
Oh,
okay.
You know, who knows if that's how it really happens, but the idea that image is out there now for millions of people to see.
So you mentioned that scene in the movie. In reality, has there ever been a report of someone seeing a crop circle being formed?
Yeah, there's at least 20 or 30 credible, you know, witness descriptions of it. And there's variations in, you know, some of them hear a buzzing noise in the distance. Several of them say that they see glowing orbs of light. There's one video of two or three orbs circling around, and the formation forms underneath it. If you want to look that up, it happened in a field called Oliver's Castle, and that was like 20 or 30 years ago. It's really hard to do because, you know, people say, why don't you just set up some videos and get some good pictures of it now that we have a good camera? But the reality is that there's literally thousands of wheat fields and stuff. Yeah. And how do you know which one on which night? The odds are just daunting. So a couple of times there's been luck involved. A couple of times there have been groups of researchers who meditate the night before. There was the famous one was a group from Japan who sort of literally put out a request for a crop circle with acknowledge their Japanese culture. And the next day in that field, there was an origami folded paper design that's unmistakably Japanese. And it's exactly what they had requested. So
so they take requests.
Oh, okay.
Maybe next season, Evan and I will go to England and request a Coors Light logo. So you've been breaking down a lot of misconceptions that I have about crop circles. And another thing is that I am of the mind that they only exist in Great Britain. Is that accurate? Do they happen anywhere else on Earth?
They do. There's actually a really good resource. It's sort of a crop circle museum near there. It's called the Visitors Access Center. And they have compiled, you know, the data. I think it's over 50 or over 60 different countries have reported the circles there. And there have been some in America, but not that many. And that goes back to the question of what is it about Southern England. There have been reports back to World War II. There's even one sort of folklore, I think it was like 1680 or something like that, where they attributed it to the devil, because other explanation could they have? There's a woodcut of the devil scything out a field. So it's not just now, but it's certainly taken off in the last 30 years. And it's still going. This last season was a particularly busy one. So I don't know whether it culminates in something or just continues to magnify. I don't know.
So is there any, because like you said, American media, they really don't talk about it at all. But in England, is there any sort of like crop circle tourism? Could I go on like a crop circle hunt or something?
Yeah, no, you can. There are a couple of well-known people who do that, who also the ones who do the flyovers.
Okay.
We had tried to arrange one for this year, but waited too long and for a bunch of reasons couldn't quite get the logistics to happen. But there's an annual conference, and outside of Avebury, there's a bookstore that's become the focal point for it. So Crop Circle Access, I think, is the name of the website. And they'll have the resources. You know, you can go to the conference online, but that's obviously not the same as being there. And there are some of the local dowsers, for example, will take you on a tour of Avebury. And because dowsing is another way to detect the energies of the stone circles or the crop circles, if there happen to be any.
You mentioned, you know, stone circles, ley lines. Is there any connection between those and where the crop circles form? Is it like, is there a rhyme or reason to where the crop circles form? Are they predictable in any sort of way?
Not exactly, but in a general way, yes. Like some of the most famous ones are, like I mentioned, the one that's across the street from Stonehenge. There's also the larger stone circle called Avebury, which is, it's fascinating because it covers a much, much bigger area than Stonehenge. The stones themselves aren't quite as tall as Stonehenge, and a lot of it has been broken down because the villagers actually use the stones to build as building material. So not all the stones are still there. But some of the aerial views are interesting because there's buildings and residences and even a pub. But out on there's one field across from this circle that every few years will have a really fabulous design. And in fact, this last year, this was one of the, I'm still not quite sure what to make of it, but we go to Avebury because we really love it. And there's a hinge is a ditch and a barrier that circles the site. And there's a path that you can walk along around the whole thing. It's probably like half a mile or something. It's so big. So my wife and I were walking along one segment of it, and it cross the road that leads back into the center of the village. And we opted to go back into the village and go to the pub and have a pint. If we had continued on, because that evening, that night on the website that posted, it said that we went on our walk at like 2:30, I think it was, and they posted, you know, drone footage. The video was posted at 4:30.
Oh my gosh.
Series of three circles right where we would have been if we had continued on to the next section. We were like 20 feet away, but there was a mound in front of it. So, you know, nobody has been able to say exactly when it formed, but there's a part of me that wants to believe that. And the other thing was that day, July 14th, was my birthday. It was my 75th birthday. And there's a part of me that will still think this was meant to be my birthday present.
Yeah, yeah, I buy it.
That's awesome.
That's a great gift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If my family's listening, I'm going to be 39 next year. I could use a crop circle.
I mean, honestly, it had been on my mind for a long time. I really want to see one.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wouldn't put it past them.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Now, this is something I've never been able to nail down. Could you explain to me what a ley line is?
I think actually it's not in my book, but it's on the website.
Okay.
There's like I don't even know my own website, but there's a picture, an image for each chapter, and the one for the one on Earth Energies is this diagram of Southern England that is the most famous ley line. Like, it's called the most St. Michael line, and it looks exactly like an acupuncture meridian, with the acupuncture points being places like Glastonbury and Avebury and Cadbury Castle, and, you know, very well-known historical places, all on a line. So that's called the ley line. And I think it is literally an acupuncture meridian of the earth.
Okay. But they're, again, not just in England. They're all over the world, right? Yeah,
that's the best known, probably been the best studied because of Western Europe and how culture has evolved. But yeah, the other indigenous peoples have legends about circles in the crops as well as places and power alignments. And the, you know, the Chinese feng shui, they have lung mei. The lung is the dragon's tail. That's the line of energy through the circle.
Is that like some kind of line of feeling or spirituality, or like, what do you feel like that is for the earth, this ley line? Like, is it key points of where we connect with it, or like, what is it?
I think the earth, in some ways, is a conscious being, like a human being or a horse or whatever, mm-hmm. and has energy pathways and a higher consciousness. I think the specific points where humans tend to gravitate to, humans can use it. And when they do ceremony there, for example, mm-hmm. whether it's prayer, meditation, or chanting or whatever, it elevates humans' consciousness so that they can access these higher levels. And there have been some studies of in the, it's not quite the same, but in the Great Pyramids in Egypt, a group of researchers from Princeton, they have a random number generator that can assess the coherence of the state of being in any location. Mm-hmm. It's high already inside the Great Pyramid. And when these guys did their group meditation inside the King's Chamber, you know, the readings were off the chart. So it's a way for humans to interact with these sacred places, these sacred structures. And I think the ultimate goal is to increase our level of consciousness. And I'm pretty sure that's what the stone circles were used for back, you know, the primitive pagans built the stone circles as part of their ceremony. There's an interesting stately home in Southern England called Stonor House, S-T-O-N-O-R, that's been there for 800 years, because there used to be a smaller stone circle there that was taken apart to build the chapel that goes with this stately home. And that was apparently a common strategy in the church to dismantle pagan sites and try to take on the power for themselves, even though they didn't know how to use it. Mm-hmm. But there's this whole attempt to sort of disconnect people from the energy of the earth that's being reversed now. And there's a whole trend to reactivate old sacred sites and hold these kind of ceremonies. So if you do go to England, you'll be able to connect.
When a lot of religious ceremonies today are repurposing pagan rituals,
right,
to what you're talking about, it seems like it's a way to try and reconnect with earth almost and get back in sync with it from a human standpoint.
Definitely. No, I grew up thinking pagans were primitive and they really didn't know anything, and thank goodness we figured out through science what's really all about.
Are there any famous ley lines in North America?
I wouldn't say the lines are famous, but you have the sites like Sedona.
Okay.
Mount Shasta is another one. And, you know, if the illustration from that Gaia Matrix book, Shelburne Falls, is some level of these meditation centers, they're not just built randomly. Like, there's one probably like 2 miles from us where the Rinpoche, the Tibetan Buddhist teacher, had a dream, had a vision. This is where you should build your center. And he was drawn to this particular spot. And it turns out it is. I think there are just different levels of consciousness. And most of us are focused on the most mundane, you know, everyday life type of thing. And sometimes we'll have a dream or a daydream or a night dream and get a glimpse of something bigger. Some people have the gift where they can readily access it. Some people can learn it through training. It's like any skill, like an athlete. You know, some people are natural athletes. Some people have to work hard to be halfway decent. But it's the same with manipulating your consciousness. If you find a modality that works for you, go with that. And the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
And so the ley lines are, this might be a very dumb question, but do they end? Is it like, you know, it goes, it's a straight line for 50 miles and that's that? Or does it wrap all the way around the earth?
Well, there are different kinds of maps on that. The best known one goes all the way across England, southern England, in a sort of diagonal line. But I don't know whether it continues into the ocean or not. I haven't. There are other drawings that I think are kind of fanciful that have networks going completely around the world. They're all very symmetrical, and it could be, but I'm not as convinced on that one yet, but I'm open to the possibility.
Speaking of all of this stuff, have you ever looked into, I think they're called the Nazca lines in South America? Do you feel like that's connected to any of this stuff?
Yes and no. I don't think the lines are exact, you know, analogy to ley lines, but I think they are in that location for a particular reason. And I think that is because they're energetically more activated sites. I've never been there, so I can't say for sure. I've been to Chaco Canyon, which had a very powerful energetic effect on me, but that's more just a location where an old civilization was centered. It's not one particular structure that.
Okay. How about Machu Picchu?
Yeah, right. That's another one. Yeah, I haven't been there either, but that's mind boggling. Just the technology they could make those stone alignment. There's a fair number around the world. There's some in Turkey that we can't make now.
Mm-hmm.
Lines that are so precise, and the stones are all different shapes. It's not like just cookie cutter. It's so something really different is going on there.
So do you feel like something like Stonehenge, or I guess even the pyramids, do you think it's just simply a lost primitive technology that allowed them to move these stones around and hoist them up? Or do you feel like there was some other forces at work to help humans build those structures?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some attempts to replicate it using what we know now with, you know, logs and ropes and manpower, and it just doesn't work. You hear stories about some of the early, I think they were Norwegian adventurers who made some of the first Western contacts with Tibet 150 years ago, and they described seeing things like chanting in a way that lifted up stones and moved physical objects. And because of Tibetans' knowledge of sort of the hidden metaphysics of behind the scene, that they could manipulate forces in ways that we couldn't even conceive of. So it wouldn't shock me if that's a big part of it. You know, one of the times we were in England, the British Museum had their special exhibit that year was about Stonehenge. And I was really looking forward to thinking, oh, wow, now finally we'll get a full explanation. And they don't even come close to it. You know, the closest they'll get is that some people say that, or
yeah,
it has often been speculated that.
Uh-huh.
I don't think the word energy was used once in the whole thing. A very, very limited perspective. And I think, you know, as you look into it, some of these esoteric explanations make more sense than the mundane ones.
So it sounds like kind of overall, you know, the earth is a living being in one way or another, and there's sort of these points of energy on the surface that humans are kind of unconsciously drawn to. And that's sort of where we've built important structures, like I'm guessing unknowingly, and they just happen to line up with the places that the energy is coming from. Is that sort of like, in a nutshell, what we're getting at?
But I would modify it, because I think the locations, they didn't just stumble on the locations. I think in those cultures, there were members who had this kind of sensitivity, whether it was to feel the energy or to get the guidance from the, you know, the spirit guides or what have you, and led at some level to build it here rather than there. So, I think it's, we don't really give them credit for, there was so much wisdom in the ancient traditions that we just have tried to erase, that it's all coming back now, though, fortunately.
So let me throw my alien theory at you.
Oh, he just left the chat, David. No, I'm just kidding.
Let me get your take on this. So part of me, my alien theory is that the UFOs that we see, and, you know, Close Encounters of the First Kind, I think it is, where we actually see beings and stuff, is that these are future humans that are coming back either to interact with us or not interact with us. I think a lot of it is like essentially time travel, but they're coming back and sort of observing. And that's why we're never able to really get near them or interact with them or anything. Occasionally something might go wrong, like Roswell or something, but sort of working that into what we've been talking about today would be that these future humans know something that we don't. And so they're trying to draw us to build things in certain places because they know something that we don't about those places.
Michael Sala, S-A-L-L-A. He's Australian and has interviewed a fair number of people in the military and government and outside who describe experiences of like underground military bases and off-planet bases and things like that. But, you know, it's easy to dismiss and say, come on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so detailed. And, you know, one guy's story is consistent with the other. And I haven't followed it all that closely, but he's got weekly updates. And if you want to pursue that line of inquiry, I think he's a good resource.
Okay. I'll have to look him up. Yeah, that's my working theory right now. But, you know, it's not based on a whole lot of knowledge. Well, Rick, I really appreciate the time you've given us today. You know, I'd love to have you back on the podcast again at some point in the future. But any last thoughts, things you want to throw out there, plugs you want to make for where people can find you?
No, I mean, I just will echo what you said. I really enjoyed the conversation and that it went in so many different directions. And just, you know, you guys are open-minded, informed, but curious. And that's a great combination to pursue. I think for people who want to learn more, my book does cover a lot of these topics. And it's, you know, there's some technical detail, but it's in a way that I think is very accessible. And it's called The Mystery of Life. And those are some places to go.
So I've been trying to convince Evan to go on a trip somewhere, like do some ghost hunting or do something energy wise. We have zero budget. Do you have any suggestions, East Coast United States, that we could go to feel something? Are we in a dead zone?
No. Seychelles Falls, actually.
We'll come have a couple Coors Lights with you.
Yeah, have a cup of tea or something. But where you're drawn, like if there's a place you've always been curious and wanted to go to or something like that.
So you would say more in general, maybe do some meditation and just go where you're drawn to, because the energy is going to draw you where you need to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, tune into it a little bit and see what might be there.
Okay.
You never know. You never know. And I think, you know, everybody's practice is going to be different. But do things that you're drawn to that help expand your field of awareness.
Okay. Evan, do you have any final questions, thoughts?
I think you kind of got there just based on like what this podcast has done for me is try not to shut stuff down too quick. So keeping my mind open to any and all possibilities. Is there anything you want to convey to people to just like keep an open mind?
You know, especially now as things are a little bit more fraught, it's much easier for folks to say, I like this and I don't like that, and, you know, black and white. But reality is way more complex than that, and it's way more beautiful than that. And that's part of the challenge is, you know, sort of the media and the culture is so designed to get everybody in an anxious state, survival mode, that it's really important for us to find a way to step away from that. It could be meditation. It could be walking in the woods, going to swim in the lake, going to a Phillies game, or, you know, whatever.
To
get you into
whatever helps you connect, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, actually, just to one more thing about sports, just the whole World Cup recently, parts of the world that really just got high levels of excitement and enjoyment. And I think it really broke through the down sort of tempo mood of the world for at least those couple of weeks. It was really wonderful to
That's a really good observation, because I didn't consciously think about that in the moment, but you're absolutely right. When the World Cup was going on, things just sort of felt a little bit better. And now that it's ended, we're kind of back where we started. But for those few weeks.
Now you're getting into the scandal of that Infantino guy who.
Oh my gosh.
But you know that, but actually there's a lot of backlash now. And it might be that the momentum that was positive vibes that were built from the World Cup could be enough to unseat him, because he's just trying to use those positive emotions to make money. And
if he goes away, we're better for it. So
not
mad at it.
All right. Well, thank you again. I don't want to keep you up too late. We're pushing on my bedtime too right now. You know, like I said, if you're open to it, I'd love to have you back on the podcast. If we had another hour, I would love to hear your theories on ghosts and poltergeist and that type of energy. So maybe we can save that for part two.
Okay. Keep an open mind about that.
Yeah, for sure.
But thanks again for inviting me on. I've really enjoyed the conversation we've had together.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick. Really appreciate it.
All right. Well, hey, thanks again.
Okay. Take care, guys. Thanks again.
All right.
I am David Stuhldreher, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. Theme music done by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tanis. You can follow her at Tanis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.